for the invitation. So I will talk about a paper that appeared recently with Scott Collier, who's a grad student at Harvard, Piotr Kravchuk, a grad student at Caltech, and Ying Xuanling, who's a postdoc at Caltech. I will discuss a simple but new method in doing conformal bootstrap that would, that is very general, can be applied in principle to conformal field theories in any dimension, and will tell us some information about not just say gap or first OP coefficient in the spectrum, but it will tell us about the distribution of OP coefficients and the spectral density of a theory. In some sense, it's a generalization of what people call the extremal functional method. Now, just as a motivational remark, but most of the application I will discuss in this talk, and which is what we did in this paper, are restricted to two-dimensional conformal field theories. And as a motivational remark, I'll just say that most of us have been lied to at some point in our career, probably early in grad school, when someone told us that we know a lot about 2D CFDs. You can look at this big yellow book, and there's everything you want to know about the theory. But then, if you're a string theorist, you want to know something about string theory on Clavial manifolds. You want to study the Nernst-Hegel model on Clavial target space, which is a CFT. You open the yellow book, you'll find nothing about that. In fact, basically, we know pretty much nothing beyond the BPS sector of the theory. This embarrassment is more dramatic when we try to think about ADS CFT correspondence, because in fact, this false sense of confidence about our understanding of 2D CFTs leads some people to say that if you have any quantum theory of gravity, put it in ADS 3, we must be able to understand it. And now we know that we are very, very far from that. In fact, we don't even know still whether there is a non-perturbative completion of pure gravity in ADS 3, in a sense, and which is tied to our ignorance about 2D CFTs. So if you think about our standard toolbox, the kind of theories we can construct usually are, either integrable, either rational theory or free theory, you can consider supercomponent theories, but usually you know something about the moduli space of exactly marginal deformation, but you know pretty much nothing else beyond that. In fact, just as a curiosity, which was part of the initial motivation for thinking about this kind of questions, you would think that the generic 2D, the nice 2D CFT would be one that is, let's say, just as motivation, suppose you had considered 2D CFT, the generic one you might think that would be considered one that's unitary and compact, meaning that there's a normalizable SL2 invariant vacuum, discrete spectrum states, finite OP coefficients, all the nice properties you want. Let's say no extra symmetry beyond Virasoro. Let's say with center charge greater than one, you would think that the generic 2D CFT should be of this type. But now I would challenge you to give me an example. I will mention one potential candidate for this, which is actually toward the end of my talk, which is actually the only potential candidate I know of this type. And there is basically one paper on this, which is on the condensed matter archive from 98. And that's just an illustration of how little we know about 2D CFTs. Okay, so now let me come to the actual content of the talk. The name of the game is that we're going to try to constrain 2D CFTs that are unitary. And I will consider both compact and non-compact theories. By non-compact, I mean typically a theory, a 2D CFT, that still obey the standard consistency relations such as associativity of OPE and modular invariance, but would know a normalizable SL2 invariant vacuum, typically with continuous spectrum of Virasoro primary operators. The non-compact CFT often arise as interesting limits of compact CFT. If you take the supersymmetric nonlinear signal model on the K3 target space, there are two different kind of non-compact limits. One is a large volume limit, where theory becomes free. The other limit is when the K3 develops ADE singularity, where we develop a continuum sector theory above a gap. Okay, so, so I will introduce a method that allows us to kind of constrain both the OPE, the structure constants of the theory, as well as the spectrum, given some appropriate assumptions. As an illustration for the kind of result you might be able to obtain using this kind of method, let me first tell you one of the conclusions. So I'll make the following claim that a 2D CFT with, let me assume that it's unitary for now. This assumption is actually, I think, is not actually essential, but for simplicity, let me assume that. CFT with C greater than 1 and Virasoro primaries of bounded spin. That is to say that if you look at the Virasoro primaries, which are labeled by left and right conformal weight, the spin is the difference between the two. It's, for this theory, is bounded by some maximal spin. I claim that there's only one such theory for each given sum charge, which is the Liouville theory. Must be Liouville. Okay, so there are, Liouville CFT has played an important role in string theory from the early days, but it took a long time before people were able to solve Liouville theory, thanks to the work of DOZZ in the mid-90s. That was a lot of hard work. And eventually one understands that Liouville theory is a consistent unitary CFT that base crossing, namely associativity of OPE, has some known structure constants which are very complicated functions that I'll maybe review briefly later. So it took a lot of effort. But now I'm claiming that actually, it's the only theory if you make this assumption. So if you make this assumption, you should be able to pin down the theory without knowing anything about other than the center charge. Let me comment that on that. A part of this is going to be analytic. The statement so far remains a conjecture, but part of this can be shown analytically. And the most non-trivial part we have numerical evidence for, which is where we need to do numerical bootstrap. There's a simple implication of this bounded spin constraint, which is easy to understand. That is, this condition from modular invariance of just the partition function of on the torus, a function of tau and tau bar, one can show by studying suitable analytic continuation of the partition function tau and tau bar that bounded spin implies that there's only zero spin, that there's only scalar primaries, that there's a continuous spectrum, and that the spectral density is that of Liouville. The argument for this is elementary, but because it's orthogonal to my talk, I won't actually review this argument. It was in the paper. It's a kind of a one-page simple derivation. Let me just say what this means. So Liouville theory, given some central charge, so for Liouville, is conventional to write Liouville central charge as 1 plus 6 q squared, where q is the background charge of Liouville theory. And the vertex operators of Liouville theory consist of Virasoro primaries that are scalars, so labeled by some Liouville momentum p, which is non-negative. And the left and right conformal weight are equal, which are equal to q squared over 4 plus p squared. In other words, this theory has a continuous spectrum labeled by this Liouville momentum p, a positive number. And there's a gap in the, there's no normalizable SL2 invariant vacuum, and the dimension is above, which is the sum of these two, is above c minus 1 over 12, which is q squared over 2. And furthermore, the spectral density is such that the spectral density is flat distribution in the momentum. So formally, the partition function, torus partition function of the Liouville theory's modular invariant is the same as that of a non-compact free boson, because these are described by some kind of scattering states, which we'll discuss in maybe a little more detail later if there's time. This is what I mean by the spectral density being that of Liouville. Okay, so this part, as I said, argument is elementary, and I will not discuss it. The much more non-trivial part is to show that given this assumption, if you have a CFT with some central charge, only scalar Virasoro primaries, and with this spectral density, that the structure constant is fixed to be that of Liouville. The claim is that if you look at the sphere four-point function, you write as a conformal block decomposition like this, and there's a crossing equation that says that if you decompose in two different channels, you must get the same answer. I claim that if you assume that there are only scalar Virasoro primaries, then the only solution to the crossing equation is given by the structure constants of Liouville theory. And this I cannot prove analytically, but I'll show you numerically that is true. Any questions? Okay, so the method we're going to use to approach this problem is what we call the special function method, for lack of a better name. I'm going to apply this both for the study of the crossing equation for sphere four-point function as well as a modular invariance of the torus partition function. Let me begin with the sphere four-point function. I can apply this to general CFT, but for the sake of this discussion, let me start with an example where I assume there are only scalar Virasoro primaries in the spectrum, just for simplicity of notation. So I can write the four-point function of four scalar operators. Let's say, also for simplicity, let me begin with a case where they're all identical operators. So this four-point function is of operator inserted at 0, 1, z, and infinity on a complex plane. I'll write this as f of zz bar. It can be decomposed into Virasoro conformal blocks of the schematic form sum of c delta squared, where delta labeled the set of scaling dimensions of primaries that appear in the OPE. And as I said, I'm going to make this simplifying assumption that they're only scalar Virasoro primaries, which of course generally will not be the case, but this is just for simplicity of notation. And then there's some Virasoro conformal block, which is labeled by the internal dimension of the conformal block decomposition, as well as the external operator dimension, which I call delta phi, which I do not write explicitly in this formula. The crossing equation is a statement this in one channel is the same as the conformal block decomposition in the other channel, which is related by mapping z to 1 minus z. So can be the Poisson equation can be written in this form. Here, I wrote this equation in a special case where the four operators are identical scalar operators. If you do this for general, whole point function is equivalent to the associativity of OPE. Just as a one thing that one does, one thing that is standard in the numerical approach to the conformal bootstrap is to work with a derivative basis. So in other words, we Taylor expand this equation around the point z equals z bar equals 1/2 replace this by derivatives. So you can write this as sum c delta squared. Let me call this fmn delta equals 0, where m plus n is odd, and the definition of m and n is that this is derivative with value z to the nth power, with value z bar to the nth power, evaluated as z bar equals 1/2 of the conformal block. So this is equivalent to that equation. The standard bootstrap type analysis is to, in the context of unitary theories where these coefficients are non-negative, is to assume, let's say here you fix the central charge, you assume that there's some gap in this OPE, and you try to exclude that, rule out such spectrum by finding some linear functional such that they take the same sign when acting on all of these things. For delta taking range in that hypothetical spectrum. And typically, if one does this kind of analysis, the sort of, usually you might expect some kind of bound like this. So as a function of the external upper dimension, you have some upper bound on the gap in the spectrum, and you rule out some, region like so. In this particular example, in fact, what you find is the following. What you find is that, let me mark some points here. Let's say this is the Liouville threshold C minus 1 over 12. This is C minus 1 over 12. What you find is that if the external operator, so here I'm again assuming only scalar versus or primaries in OPE. That was a strong assumption. So then you find that this bound actually basically rules out everything over here. And it, it looks like as you improve the numerics, you try to optimize the bound, you will find something that kind of converges to a flat bound like so at value c minus 1 over 12 for sufficiently large delta phi, and then there's a jump at a place over here. This value is 3/4 of the Liouville threshold. So the claim is that if delta phi, so just based on this analysis, which is a standard one, if delta phi is bigger than, say, 3/4 of the Liouville threshold, you must have operators in the OPE starting at Liouville threshold. This result, as far as I know, was first found in unpublished work by Baltimore Rees a few years ago. I'll tell you about the interpretation of it later. But we're going to do something that will exceed this result. I will tell you much more information. Because by this kind of analysis, you'll say something about the first operator in the OPE, but want to say something about all operators in the OPE. So now let me introduce this special function method. This eraser is up here. the definition of a special function is very simple. It's in fact very trivial. The non-trivial thing is that we can actually put useful bounds on it. Let me look at this conformal block decomposition. And let me evaluate at the self-dual point z equals z bar equals 1/2. Now, if I do the sum, I get the four-point function at the self-dual point. But now let me truncate this sum up to some cutoff dimension delta star. And let me normalize this for the convenience of definition. Let me normalize this by the four-point function itself, which is this. So this quantity, let me call it f of delta star. OK, so now clearly, this function f of delta star is in the unitary CFT is going to be a monotonic function that ranges from 0 and 1 by definition. So for any known theory, you can calculate this for some particular four-point function. I mean, of identical operators, it would look like this. So this f of delta star, there's going to be some vacuum contribution, and then there's take some step function form. Of course, the high-dimensional operator contribution will be exponentially suppressed, like so. Okay. So the idea now is that we want to, given any kind of assumption you make on the spectrum of theory, such as there are only scalar operators or scalar primary operators and things like that, one can try to put bounds on the special function, both upper and lower bounds. And the way we'll do this is the following. consider the following inequality, which may or may not be satisfied. I'll take the step function theta of delta star minus delta. So for fixed delta star, I fix this cutoff dimension. Delta is a variable. It varies. So this takes value 1 below the cutoff and 0 above the cutoff. And I use this and multiply by the conform block itself, evaluated at zz bar equals a half. I guess I erased that. But in my notation, this is the conform block itself with no derivative, the 0, 0 representing no derivative on the conform block. And then let me add to it some y coefficient, y 0, 0 times the conform block. Then add to it sum m plus n odd, so m and n are non-negative integers, y mn f mn delta. And let's say this is greater than or equal to 0. That what I want to do is that I want to seek coefficients, these are real coefficients, y 0, 0, y mn, such that this thing holds for all delta. In this case, delta is greater than 0. More generally, you can assume that it obeys whatever assumption you want to put in, say some gap or something like that. OK, so let's make this assumption. So suppose you find a set of real coefficients, the y0, 0, and the ymn for n plus n odd, such that this inequality is obeyed. I'll call this star. And then if you have a CFT, you will immediately know, that based on all your assumptions, you will know that you can take this equation, which is supposed to hold simultaneously for all delta, and multiply by the OP coefficient squared and sum over the spectrum, that will still be, that will still be greater than or equal to 0. If you do that, though, the sum of C delta squared OP coefficients multiplying MN delta, that is equal to 0 by virtue of the crossing equation, which I guess I've erased, which I shouldn't have erased, but as you might remember, the sum of C delta squared FMN delta equals 0, that was a crossing equation. So if you sum over the C delta squared multiplying this term is gone, and then you're left with something very simple, the sum of C delta multiplying the conform block is the four-point function itself, and this one is the truncated four-point function, so the ratio of that is a special function. So, and the four-point function is, for identical scalar operators, is positive at for cross ratio of z between 0 and 1. That's a general result for unitary CFT. So it follows that, it follows from this that, so if this is satisfied, then the special function as I defined plus y00 is greater than or equal to 0. Okay, so I'm just doing this and divide both sides by the four-point function. Okay, so that's equivalent to, that's the same as saying that minus y00 is a lower bound on the special function. Just as perhaps an example to illustrate what's really going on here, if you use a very naive approximation of the conformal block, which is strictly speaking not correct, but it's a leading order term in the expansion across ratio, you might take f delta z bar to be of the form z to the minus 2 delta phi plus delta. Is the conformal block is this plus higher order terms in z. This is a leading term in the OPE. So if you, let's say, take the first order derivative with back to z, and also with back to, let's say, set z bar to be equal to z for real z of this f, so let's write f1, 0 over f0, 0, that's basically delta minus 2 delta phi. Okay, so plus corrections. So if you look at this inequality, what is it doing? So you have so let's say you pick some delta star. You start with some step function like so, and you shift it by y zero. You want y zero to be negative for this bound to be non-trivial. So you shift it by y zero zero. Let's say you shift it down to here. So now it's negative over here, but you want to add it to something that makes it positive everywhere. This, as a function of delta, crosses 0 at 2 delta phi. So let's say, suppose 2 delta phi is over here. And then you can imagine that some linear function. You can choose these arbitrary coefficients, which is this ymn here. And you can make the sum of this with this linear function to be positive everywhere. So if you once you achieve that, you will find a lower bound on f of delta star. So it says a lower bound on special function. So in fact, even this very, very simple analysis already tells you something non-trivial. It actually can give you a non-trivial constraint on the tail distribution of the contribution of high-dimensional operators to the OPE. So that's essentially a known result from the work of Richkov et al. Some years ago. But now we can try to optimize this numerically. Numerically, what you can do is you try to, obtain the optimal bound. The optimal lower bound is achieved by minimizing y00 subject to this inequality star. So this is a standard linear programming problem, which right now there are standard tools, such as the package SDPB, written by David Simon Stefan, which is a standard tool for doing this kind of analysis. This in practice, oh, by the way, I should say that you can, of course, also change the sign here, less than or equal to 0. You can consider the opposite inequality and maximize y00 subject to the opposite inequality and get an upper bound on the special function. Now, in practice, this can be done numerically somewhat efficiently, provided that you can calculate these conformal blocks to some precision. That is achieved using Zamolodchikov's recursion relation. So that allows to calculate somewhat efficiently of these conformal blocks to a reasonably high level. For our application, at some point we needed to use conformal block up to level 200, which is really requires this kind of recursion relation. Because if you try to enumerate the descendants to level 200, there's no way a computer can do this. So let me tell you what the result looks like. In fact, I'm trying to see if I should switch to the computer. Let me switch to the computer for the moment. I should start. Okay. Okay, so this was the plot I sketched to you earlier. This will be given external upper dimension, the bound on the gap will schematically look like this. Now we're going to be talking about the special function of, with the assumption that there are only scalar versus or primaries. It looks like this. Here I pick, to do this numerically, you have to pick some value of the central charge. Maybe I can. I guess I can use this. Actually, this is not the, okay, never mind, that doesn't matter.
Just remove the USB and it'll work.
Oh, okay. Well, Canadian style, very good. So I pick central charge, let's say 8, some moderate value. And here I just take an example where this external upper dimension, actually, this is the half of the scaling dimension, is chosen to be right at the Liouville threshold. This is actually not essential for the, you know, for this plot, but as an example. Then one has to, numerically, one has to truncate that. One has to, so there's a sum over mn, where m plus n is odd. Numerically, you can truncate that sum. If you truncate the sum, to some derivative order, you will not get the optimal bound, but you get some bound which will still be in principle rigorous, provided that you have the accurate conformal block. So at low derivative order, you'll exclude some region above this line over here. So this is supposed to be the special function which ranges from 0 to 1. The horizontal axis is the cutoff component dimension. So exclude some region over here and exclude some region down here. And as you increase the numerical sophistication by including more and more these derivatives, you get stronger and stronger bounds, and they start to merge toward one another. And if you actually use the structure constants of Liouville theory and compute by integrating the Liouville structure constant squared multiplying by the Virasoro conformal block, numerically, you integrate that, you'll find this curve that sits in between, which is the special function of Liouville theory in this case. So one might suspect that if you go to arbitrary high numerical, if you optimize the numerics by taking n to be very large, perhaps they will converge toward the Liouville special function. Now, I should say that this method puts rigorous bounds on the special function, but the convergence is rather slow, so it's not very efficient, in going to in pinning down the special function. But at least it gives you some non-trivial bounds. Maybe I should just briefly recap what goes into this Liouville special function. I mean, the usual Liouville theory at the level of the semi-classical theory, you can write down some action. You have some vertex operator, which represents, in the mini-superspace approximation, some scattering wave that goes in and out, scattered off the Liouville potential. They are labeled by this Liouville momentum, P. The reflection coefficients, as well as the three-point functions, are known explicitly. There's some formula for these. So here's the Liouville structure constants. Involves some Barnes double gamma function, which is defined by this integral. They have some nice analytic property. They are entire functions with simple zeros that has some physical significance. Anyway, there's some very non-trivial formula. And that's the formula that computes this curve that sits in the middle here. Okay, so if you actually assume that the upper and lower bounds will actually coincide as you optimize the numerics, which amounts to saying that. So earlier I wrote this inequality like so. Where here you have m plus n odd. So for numerics, we make the truncation on the sum, which does not affect the validity of the bound, just not optimized. You can consider this inequality, minimize y00 subject to this, or you can maximize y00 subject to the opposite inequality. And so you might expect that if the upper and lower bounds coincide, in the limit when you send n to infinity, this truncation on derivative orders to infinity, maybe you'll be able to solve the equality. If you can solve this, I mean, equality simultaneously for all delta. This is for fixed delta star. You try to satisfy this for all delta for some y00 and ymn. You know, viewed as some constraints on functions in delta, where nothing, this is nothing but kind of decomposing this step function on some basis, which may or may not be complete. Or could be overcomplete. But this can be done numerically also. So you know, you can pick some appropriate basis of functions on the half real axis. You can choose that basis, for instance, to be these functions themselves. And then you can choose an appropriate integration measure in delta that defines some appropriate norm. Then you have now a Hilbert space of functions on the half real line. And so you can take this equation, truncate in some suitable way, and take its inner product with that basis functions using this inner appropriate inner product that you define, and then you will turn this into a matrix equation. Then you can invert some big matrix and solve for y00 and ymn. Now, the solution for ymn may not be universal because this basis could be overcomplete. But if the upper and lower bounds do coincide, there should be some solution, and there'll be some well-defined solution for y00, which will pin down the value of that special function. So this can be done. This can be done directly using Mathematica. There's nothing too fancy as required. The only thing is that depending on the range of central charge and the conformal weights, sometimes we discover that for the numerical instability to settle down, we have to compute this conformal block to very high precision. But if you do that, you find a result. So you can compute this y00 for each delta star, and you make a plot. And that plot looks, as an example, looks like this. So in fact, so in this plot, this dotted blue line was the actual special function of Liouville theory one obtains by integrating the DOZZ strike constant with the conformal block. And this red line, which basically coincides with this, as you can see here, and here, down here, there's some wiggles. That's the answer we get by solving a truncated version of this equation. So there's a quite nice agreement. This wiggle settles down as you go to higher numerical truncation. So that, I would say, is a fairly convincing evidence that the DOZZ formula is the only solution to the crossing equation under the assumption that they're only scalar primaries. There's no actual assumptions put in. We did not make any assumption on the gap. As you can see here, this is non-zero over here. In fact, here, we did not even assume unitarity. So previously, for this upper and lower bounds, unitarity was essential because unitarity was essential because you know, there are these inequalities. I need the c delta squared to be positive. But if I solve this equality, I do not need to assume unitarity. And in fact, this wiggles indicates clearly that unitarity is not manifest, because if it's unitary, this function will be monotonic. But even without that assumption, it seems that this is the only solution to the crossing equation. So that's the evidence for the claim. I should say that here, there's one caveat that I have ignored, which is a possibility for further degeneracy of the scalar spectrum. In that case, one can also make a conjecture, and we have some partial numerical tests for this, which is that, in fact, the only solution to the crossing equation in that case would be essentially several copies of decoupled Liouville theory. Not to be confused with tensor products, or decoupled Liouville theory, by which I mean the tensor product of a Liouville theory with a topological quantum field theory. So that appears to be the only possibility, even if the spectrum is degenerate. Okay, so now I'm going to switch gear and talk about applying the same thing for the analysis of modular constraints on the partition function. So the idea is exactly the same. Instead of talking about the sphere four-point function, we consider the torus partition function of a CFT. And instead of component block decomposition, we decompose the partition function in Virasoro characters. So we have some sum of some positive coefficients, which are degeneracy of primaries, and then some Virasoro character chi h tilde of this function of tau and tau bar. And in this case, we'll be interested in the modular invariance. Tau goes to minus 1 over tau, and similarly tau bar. We'll play the same game. We can define this FMN in exactly the same way, provided that let's say you write tau as I e to the z, just for the sake of it, let me write tau as e to the I times e to the z minus a half, then the crossing, the modular crossing relation is the same as z equals to 1 minus z. Once again, it's identical to before, other than that the component block is replaced by the appropriate Virasoro character, which is much simpler. So you can do that. So now we will not, we can put in some other assumption. You can put in the assumption that there's some gap in the spectrum and things like that, and get some non-trivial constraints on the what we call the modular spectral function. The modular spectral function, defined similarly as the sphere four-point spectral function, is again a function that ranges from 0 to 1, and it takes some, for compact CFT, it will be some kind of step function like so. And you can try to put the bounds on it, given some assumptions on the spectrum. In fact, it's kind of remarkable how, you know, the modular invariance is something, you know, is part of the definition of a CFT, something that we take for granted. We know how to derive the growth of asymptotic growth of states of a CFT from modular invariance. Apart from that, it seems that previously most of the thinking, the modular invariance is either afterthought or is as a way to verify the consistency of the CFT. It wasn't explored previously so much of, you know, just how much this modular invariance itself actually constrain the spectrum of the CFT beyond just the asymptotic growth. And this was that business was started with the work of Simeon Hellerman in 2009, which we then subsequently refined. So let me first remind you how that works. This one was from a paper last August. Just from modular invariance, you would know that given central charge of a CFT, you can put a upper bound on the dimension of the first primary operator in the theory. In the 2009 paper of Simeon Hellerman, he showed that there's an upper bound of order C over 6. In the subsequent work of Frieden and Keller, they tried to optimize that result with numerics. It was thought at the time that there was not a significant improvement. Numerically, you know, you cannot get much better than that, which was disappointing. In fact, you can. And the reason for that, for the, you know, previous pessimism, was that in fact, you know, numerically, in order to optimize these bounds, you have to use rather complicated linear functionals involving very high derivative order linear functionals acting on that modular crossing equation. It appears that the bigger the central charge is, the more complicated, the higher derivative order you have to go to optimize the numerical bound. So Frieda and Keller went up to order 23, which was fairly high. If you want to check this by hand, going to 23 derivative order is quite hard, but it was not enough. It would be give reasonable bounds for reasonably close to optimal bounds for small c, but even for moderate value of c, like 30 or so, it would not work. It's somewhat far from the optimal bound. So this we try to optimize, but still numerically it became harder and harder. Central charge is very large. We still don't know what the asymptotic bound on this gap from modular invariance is at very large c, but this is sort of the optimized plot. That's not really a subject of this talk. I just want to point out that you can also bound, put upper bound on the dimensional lattice scalar. So previously that was a plot, which is this blue line here. That was for, that's the upper bound on the gap in the dimension of all operators of any spin. But if you look at scalar operators, if you focus on just scalar operators, numerically you can also get a bound, which is strictly weaker, generally, of course, by definition. It looks like this red curve here, which has some interesting features. For example, there's a kink over here, which corresponds to central charge 8, and this bound on the gap in the scalar spectrum is equal to 2. So it implies that, for example, any unitary CFT of central charge less than 8 must have a relevant operator. Okay, so that's the results that follow from this simple analysis. You can ask if there are theories that saturate these bounds, and there are. This is the same plot. There are some theories that saturate the bounds in fact with enhanced symmetry. So there are WZ level models at level 1 of these symmetry groups, SU2, SU3, G2, SO8, and E8, they saturate these bounds. So let me just comment on this E8 theory here. Of course, we know what the theory is, but one can ask, if the bound is saturated, is the theory really pinned down to be this? And the answer is yes. Previously there was this extremal functional method, which I won't really review in detail here, that can allow you to pin down the spectrum, but it's not as nice. But I won't say too much about that for now. I'll just show you this plot, which is the constraints on the modular spectral function. So this is again c equals 8. I impose a gap on the scalar Virasoro primaries, which is equal to 2. So that was the bound on the previous plot. And in this case, it turns out that the upper and lower bounds nicely have converged on top of one another, which pins down the spectral function, the modular spectral function to be of this form. And from this, you can read off both the spectrum, which are these the horizontal position of these steps, as well as their degeneracy. Just kind of go back and look how much they contribute, you will know the degeneracy. So that pins down the spectrum. So this method is, in general, if your assumption does not pin down the spectrum, that's okay. You will still be able to find some such bounds, just that they won't converge. But you'll still get some non-trivial results. For example, one of the questions that people have asked in the past and is still not answered is, if you want to look for a holographic dual of a something like a pure theory of quantum gravity in ADS3, what would this, do they exist? And if they do, what does the CFT look like? The CFT is expected to have large central charge and a large gap in the spectrum. In fact, I would say that any large C CFT with a gap in the spectrum of order central charge itself would be called a holographic dual of a pure theory of gravity. Because in the bulk ADS3, we're talking about a theory with a mass gap of order the Planck scale. So from the effective theory point of view, that is a pure quantum theory of gravity by in every sense that we understand such a theory should be. But of course, we don't actually know any explicit construction of such CFTs. In fact, very rarely do we actually know explicit construction of CFTs with no relevant or marginal operators. It's hard, they're isolated. So the only thing you can really do, unless you happen to land on such a theory, you have to try to bootstrap. And so this is sort of really the most preliminary step, is that you try to understand what does the modular invariance tell you if you just impose such a gap. I said that modular invariance will put a gap, upper bound on the gap of, say, all spin operators, which is this blue line here. And you might say that maybe I want to get close to that bound. That will be, that'll look like a theory of pure gravity. I want to impose a gap that's somewhat close to this bound, or maybe at the bound, and see what happens. If you do that, you will find the following modular spectral function. Again, it's a function that ranges from 0 to 1. What it is that it tells you how much is the contribution from primary states up to some dimension to the partition function of the CFT at the self-dual temperature. So previously, for the sphere four-point spectral function, that was at the self-crossing symmetric cross ratio. This will be evaluated at the self-dual temperature. So this is an example of C equals center charge 100, and we impose a dimension, a gap in the scaling dimension of primaries, which is at 12, that is actually close to the numerically the optimal bound. And there's upper bound and lower bound, and they get reasonably close to one another. The numerics can improve further, but we stop here. So it basically takes a value 1/2 over some range of dimension, and then it rises. Now this has a holographic interpretation. So far I didn't put in any information other than assumption of center charge and the gap. If you think the center charge is large enough, it should have a holographic interpretation, and it does. In fact, if you calculate the contribution to this modular spectral function from a semi-classical pure gravity in ADS3, you will take account of contribution of ADS3 vacuum and the BDZ black hole, together with its perturbative corrections, which is actually not visible from this kind of plot. It's a very small correction. You'll find this blue curve. Basically, it'll take the value 1/2 over here, approximately, and it rises over here, which is precisely in between this upper and lower bounds. So expect that, in fact, in this regime over here, these upper and lower bounds will converge if you, let's say, maximize the gap that's allowed by modular invariance. Of course, if you do that, you're supposed to get some step function, but the step function has very fine steps, which will not be visible for this large central charge. This, I would say, is a confirmation that, at least in this regime, the bulk effective field theory intuition works. Previously, due to the work of Hartmann, Keller, and Stoica, they show that if you have a sparse spectrum of the CFT, defined in the appropriate sense, the BDZ black hole entropy should capture the density of states in a universal way above C over 6, above the dimension C over 6, which basically is this right in the center here. So here, this plot goes kind of beyond the range considered in their work. So this is right around C over 6, and halfway here is C over 12. Now, this is the most interesting regime as far as I'm concerned, because there's something very funny about BDZ black holes in ADS3. So the BDZ black hole has a threshold, which is C over 12. It's basically the same as Liouville threshold at large C. That is, below this threshold, there's no BDZ black hole. Above the threshold, you have a large BDZ black hole. In fact, once you go a little bit above C over 12, let's say by any amount that is of order C, let's say 1.1 times the threshold, you immediately have a macroscopic BDZ black hole whose horizon radius is at the scale of ADS curvature. So you would think that Let's say if you want to calculate the entropy of this busy black hole, the Bekenstein-Hawking formula surely should be valid because it has a macroscopic horizon. But on the other hand, if you try to calculate this from in an honest way, which is from the Euclidean gravity path integral, you run into a puzzle, which is that if you have a BTC black hole between of mass between silver 12 and silver 6, it has some temperature. These BTC black holes in this range, they never dominate the canonical ensemble. They're always subleading in the canonical ensemble at the, that corresponding temperature. So if you calculate the Euclidean gravity path integral with this temperature, the ADS3 vacuum always dominates, and BTC black hole is always exponentially suppressed. And so, you know, who knows what other non-perturbative corrections are there for the 3D pure gravity path integral. So we don't really know that the Bekenstein-Hawking formula is universal, even for theory of pure gravity, because we don't know what this non-perturbative completion is. So here, this is a confirmation that kind of works around in the neighborhood of silver 6, but the question I was asking about this kind of small but large BTC black hole, small in the sense that they are below, they never dominate the canonical ensemble, but large in the sense that they have a microscopic horizon, lies somewhere down here, and their contribution to this special function is exponentially suppressed. Numerically, we actually don't have enough resolution to tell what is going on. But in principle, there's a well-defined question. Let's say you can try to maximize these bounds, which will pin down the special function. You can ask, how does it behave over here? Is the density of states, with the density of states over here for this kind of extremal spectrum, would it agree with the BTC black hole entropy, or does it not agree? And we still don't know the answer to that. Now one can, so far, I showed you some example of either confirming the uniqueness of some known theory, given some set of assumptions that pins down the potential pins down the theory, or in this case, there's some unknown theory which we don't really know whether it exists or not. You can ask, you know, is there some interesting example of some CFT that we really want to solve, and we know it should exist, and we only know partial information. Maybe we can get some new inputs from this kind of bootstrap analysis. And previously, in other papers, we studied, we considered the OP analysis and the kind of bootstrap analysis for superconformal theories such as nonlinear signal model on K3 surface, as well as Calabi-Yau models. I won't discuss those results here. I want to mention one example where we are trying to apply some of this kind of technique to. So at the beginning of the talk, I posed the question of looking for the generic 2D CFT, which is supposed to be unitary, compact, have no actual conserved higher spin currents beyond Virasoro, and with C greater than one. And I know one such candidate example. This I've mentioned already, so let me talk about this. So I know one potential example, which was contained in this paper, in 98 paper on the condensed matter archive. It's the following. It's called the coupled pots model. You take the C equals 4/5 three-state pots model defined by the non-diagonal modular invariant. You take three copies of it. Generally, you can consider n copies of it, but the 3 is the first non-trivial case where it flows to an interesting fixed point. If you deform the theory by a relevant operator, which is the sum of epsilon I, epsilon j, I less than j from 1 to 3, so epsilon I is the energy operator in the three-state pots model, has dimension 4/5. This thing together has dimension 8/5. It's a relevant operator. You can perturb the theory by this operator. Now, if you impose a symmetry, so there's S3 semi-direct product with Z3 cube symmetry of this model. And there are actually only two relevant operators which are invariant under that symmetry. One is this, the other one is the sum of the energy operators. You can fine tune away the coefficients of this operator, and then this generates a RG flow. It's, by the way, very similar to create an OM model in three dimensions. So here n is 3. As far as I know, nobody has studied this using one-on-one expansion, but this is a in principle a straightforward thing to do. If you plot a new fixed point, in the UV, the central charge is about, is of course, we know it's 2.4. In the IR, the central charge is about 2.38. It's a short RG flow, but it operates at quite larger than one dimension, generally. This has been calculated using conformal perturbation theory, which, according to this paper, agrees with within some numerical error to result from Monte Carlo study based on lattice description of these models. So here one can try to study the modular spectral function of this just from the modular invariance and see what kind of constraint one can get. Now here I'm going to use a slightly different version of the modular spectral function. I use something called a counting function. So the counting function is a very stupid thing. I just define it to be the number of primaries up to some dimension. So it's the value is an integer. I can put upper and lower bounds on this counting function by a slight modification of this inequality I introduced earlier. So numerically, this can be achieved. The first few, so there's a vacuum here. So this just counts the number of operators. So there's one from the vacuum. There's the 6 operators down here. Then there are 2 operators here, 8 operators here, and I think another 6 operators. No, sorry. I think this is 12 over here and maybe 8 over here. So this is no. So you can ask, given this data, well, what can you say for modular invariance? Actually, you can say something slightly non-trivial. So just from modular invariance, you will know that this counting function is actually bounded from above and from below by this curve over here. And below, there's another curve over here. I didn't plot the entire curve. I just plot up to just above dimension 1. So whatever it is has to lie in between for the next few operators. So and you also know by the structure of conformal perturbation theory, you will know the degeneracy of the next few operators. They're actually 6, 6, and 12, respectively. So they have to sit somewhere over here. They could move further to the right, but they cannot move further to the left. So this will give a lower bound on the next three scaling dimensions. As you can see, you can get some non-trivial constraints. It's not terribly constraining, but we hope to do better by combining these with OP analysis, which we have yet to do. But it's just one example that shows you how this could be used to constrain unknown theories. Of course, in this example, one could, in principle, try to calculate these operator dimensions by conformal perturbation theory. Nobody has done the calculation. It's straightforward, but pretty tedious. We can do and can try to check against this. But here we don't have to think. We just put this on the computer. We can come up with the bounds and make some predictions. So I think that's all I have to say. Thank you.
So first question is there any kind of interesting bound on compactness that you can have? Because you have this window which sort of limits by how much your spectral function can jump. At finite truncation or something like that, right? So even then you can probably say, I certainly cannot have more than, I cannot have a finite step that's much larger than something. Is that interesting at all to look at?
You're talking about the case of the modular spectral function.
The previous one, no, the actual.
The four-point function. Yeah. Well, for the four-point function, so a priori, you don't know how big the steps would have to be, right? Because they depend on OP coefficients.
Oh, right.
Of course, it puts bounds on OP coefficients, but it depends on what you know and what you want to take as input.
Right. I mean, the fact that we got something that's very smooth for DOZZ just means that Uville has, a continuum.
Sure.
A continuous spectrum, but, otherwise we would have expected some staircase.
That's right. That's right. So, in that case, in the case when we only make an assumption that the only scalar threshold primaries, we expect this to pin down Liouville. But in general, of course, it will not. And let's say if you assume that if you don't put any assumption on the spin, so all CFTs are allowed. Of course, you'll still get some trivial bound actually, but they're rather weak. So there's some region that is allowed. But you know, you decide what assumption you want to put in. So you can assume that maybe there's a large gap in the spectrum, which, in which case you might pin down this further.
I have another question, and the second one is, have you thought of this other class of spectral functions that actually measure, you know, let's say chaos? You know, something that will tell you what's the distribution of gaps between nearby scaling operators, between nearby eigenvalues of the scaling operator. Can those be bootstrapped? Because we know nothing about non-integrable, actually chaotic or measures of chaos in 2D CFD.
So here, you're thinking about some kind of torus two-point function, basically?
I can even anything that counts some spectrum of primaries. So presumably, we can even think about.
Well, I mean, this is a count of the spectrum primary, but
For instance, so it's just a different kind of spectral functions. But like, have you thought about bounding that?
I certainly haven't thought about that.
Or like the spectral form factor, which people have computed things like
the
that.
The spectral form factor.
We can talk.
Okay, so there's a technical reason why here we want to work at the self-dew temperature, whereas in this case of a spectral form factor, we have to end and continue in tau and tau bar. Here, the technical reason why we want to work at the self-dew temperature, and also in the previous case, we want to evaluate at the self-dew crossing ratio, was for actual numerical stability and also numerical efficiency, because if you compare the two sides of the crossing equation, if you're not evaluating the self-dew point, they differ by the contribution from high-level primary differ by some exponential factor. In SDPP, you have to approximate all these functions of weights by polynomials. So you have to do some polynomial approximation of exponentials, which affects numerical stability. If they have the same exponential on the two sides, you can strip that off, and so you don't have to worry about this, which is why this is convenient. Now, if you want to directly bound the spectral form factor, that numerically that would be quite hard. I don't know analytically what one can say. The continuation to Lorentzian signature is, it's interesting. To come up with bound, you have to be able to fit in the positivity condition. And if you just evaluate this at some arbitrary point in the modulus, sometimes you have various phases or signs that goes in and can spoil. Numerically, there will be issues with the stability.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.